Bevor es losgeht, möchte ich unseren heutigen Werbepartner HRS vorstellen. Für euch die Seite myhrsvorteile.de. Was findet ihr dort? Da findet ihr die HRS Reiseplattform, die auch schon im App Store seit vielen, vielen Jahren ist. Sie waren die ersten im App Store seit 45 Jahren, wirklich Pionier in der Hotelbranche, familiengeführtes Unternehmen, stark fokussiert auf Geschäftsreisende, deswegen für Leute, die viel rumfahren, so wie mich, einfach der beste Partner. Ihr findet dort die beliebtesten Business-Hotels, häufig bis zu 30% billiger. Ihr könnt kostenlos stornieren bis 18 Uhr des Reisetages. Ganz, ganz vielen Hotels ist das möglich. Das kenne ich sonst kaum. Ihr könnt Meilen sammeln bei Miles & More Bahn Bonusprogramm. Ihr habt ein Express-Check-In, Express-Check-Out. Es gibt einen Traveler Care 24 Stunden. Und nur nochmal zu der Seite myhrsvorteile.de. Dort könnt ihr von vielen Vorteilen profitieren. Und vor allem könnt ihr, wenn ihr euch da einwählt, einen 5-Sterne-Hotelgutschein für 2 Personen, jeweils 2 Übernachtungen inklusive Frühstück gewinnen. Zusammengefasst, HRS ist die Lösung für Geschäftsreisen, mit der man Geld, Zeit und Nerven spart. Und wenn ihr es nochmal genau wissen wollt, myhrsvorteile.de. Welcome to the On the Way to New Work podcast. We're still in Berlin with Singularity University, the Germany Summit, Future Speed Impact. And I'm very proud to talk to Jeffrey Rogers. Hello, Jeffrey.
Hello. Thanks for having me.
Perfect timing to meet you. You just gave your speech. I think people loved what you told us. Some were a little bit scared, maybe. But maybe we start, before we talk about your topics, we start with you as a person. So where were you born? Where did it all start?
Sure. I was born in Austin, Texas, and lived there for about 22 years. And then I moved to Berkeley, California to go to graduate school. And I had the plan at the time that I was going to move west. And I did a graduate degree in history, actually, which is funny because now I'm here talking about the future with people. But I went out to California to study history, environmental history, and human ecology, and had this idea that I might become a great historian of the American West. And as it turned out, that was maybe not what I was cut out for. I turned out to probably not be the greatest graduate student and had very wandering focus, kind of spent a lost half decade in graduate school, but I managed to eke out a master's degree, get a little ways into a PhD, dropped out of academia, and wasn't sure what to do after that. But I found first that as a marginal grad student who was always looking for more funding, I'd had to teach almost every semester because I couldn't get a lot of other funding sources. So by the time I wrapped up my kind of slog through graduate school, I perhaps wasn't going to be a great historian, but I'd become a good teacher. And I started to work in education. And I kind of found my way in and out of higher ed and for-profit and not-for-profit, digital learning, experiential learning in the formal classroom, outside doing youth leadership development in the mountains in California. And after a while, I think I realized that maybe that was the thing that I was good at, that it didn't even necessarily matter what I was teaching so much as that I could teach and that I could facilitate an experience with people and help them maybe be able to do something together that they didn't feel like they could do on their own. And that kind of became a foundational principle for forging the rest of my career. And weirdly, I actually started to make my way back towards some of my interests from graduate school, where I spent a lot of time worrying about the degradation of the environment and reading Buckminster Fuller and thinking about Spaceship Earth and kind of worrying about the future, and eventually found this educational and facilitation track taking me to Singularity, where it turned out to be the perfect place to think about the future and the fact that we are in a singular moment in time where I think there's a growing awareness and a growing need to be aware of this idea of all being in it together and that this is a closed system that we're living in and we need to think of new ways to commit ourselves to stewardship of that system.
Wow. Did you have teachers in high school or graduate school where you said, wow, this was different? Do you have role models or where did it come from? I mean,
so both of my parents were in education, and I think that helped. I never wanted to be a teacher when I was growing up. In fact, I think in part because that was something my parents were affiliated with, I saw myself doing something dramatically different. But I was fortunate throughout my life to have a number of really strong role models and mentors, and some in the education space and some outside of it, who I think later on had provided a lot of really strong experiences for me to draw upon, to look back at what really made this thing stand out and how might I be able to borrow some of that and incorporate that into my own practice as it started to grow.
So I have two sons, 22 and 19, and the elder one, he really hated school. He hated most of his teachers. I do hope that no one listens to our podcast. I think the problem was this upfront situation in the classroom, and now he's studying in a very, very modern university called Zeppelin University in Germany, where they make group work, different styles, work styles, and now he's a very, very good student. So what do you think, how do we have to change the way of teaching and learning? What do you think are the main pillars of it?
The strange thing to me about this is that we actually know how to do it right. What you're describing, project-based, generally cooperative and social learning that's focused on doing and generally has a more favorable instructor-to-student ratio, we know that that's the way to facilitate the best outcomes. A lot of the problem is doing that at scale, right? Part of the reason why we have now kind of a falling apart industrialized education system is that it was something that we were able to implement at a very large scale and basically take what had worked pretty well for a different era of society and then continue to scale it up as the population grew and as you had to serve theoretically more and more and more and more constituents. But we wound up with a system that was grossly unresponsive to a changing context. And now I think people are really coming around to the idea that it's not in any way adequate to the future that we're trying to prepare people to thrive in. And so I think we can kind of reconsider, well, what do we know that works? What do we know that doesn't work? And I think the crux of it is going to be figuring out how to do those things that work at scale. And that's one of the reasons I think people are so interested right now in figuring out how to incorporate more e-learning technologies, more digital experiences, because that is something that is easier to scale. Whereas it's really hard to scale the experience of learning. I had some strange gigs earlier in my career as an educator that I think were some of the best educational experiences I've been part of creating. And these were deeply immersive. One of them I'll tell you about just because I think it's a unique example. I was working at the San Francisco National Historic Maritime Park, which is on the water in San Francisco. There's a national park there that's devoted to the maritime history of the Pacific Coast. And that park has a nonprofit association that puts on public programs. And we work with school children and school districts from all up and down the California coast around San Francisco. And our signature program was one focused on building communication skills and leadership and self-sufficiency among fourth and fifth grade children. And they would come and they would stay overnight on one of the old ships in the park's collection. And we presented that program in character, in costume, with a full-on narrative construction where the kids would come on and we would tell them that it was 1906. And they're on the San Francisco coast, and they've just been conscripted to be the crew aboard this ship. And, you know, the captain realizes belatedly that they're all fourth and fifth graders, so we can't actually go anywhere, but he can keep them for one night and put them to work. And anyway, we put them through the whole thing, and over the course of the evening, they settle into this really disorienting environment where they have strange adults talking sometimes in peculiar accents, barking orders at them in a language that's largely undecipherable. But through the course of the program, each of the students on their little teams starts to pick up pieces so that they can come together and solve new problems and do things that none of them would probably have been able to do alone. But over the course of a few hours, as they're given opportunities to learn together and to fail and then to try again and to realize it doesn't really matter that much if you get it wrong the first time, we would see, I think, pretty remarkable experiential learning and even growth over the course of, you know, 18 hours together. And it was an amazing thing. It was amazing for me to be part of. And I still meet people around San Francisco who, when I tell them that I used to work there, these people are in their, you know, 30s in some cases, they'll recall having been on that program as a child. And they'll remember some of the staff, some of the characters who are on the program. And it makes a real impact. And I think, to me, the lesson there is, again, that we know ways to make learning stick, to make it engaging, to make it appealing, and to make it serve what people really want to achieve. But we have to figure out ways to make it more accessible.
So it's about money, I guess. It's because what I learned from you in the beginning is that we have a system which works like it works because one teacher in front of 30 people is cheap. Right? Mm-hmm. So there will be no money. So we will have to do it without money. We have to do it with clever ideas. So what do you think is possible in with the budgets we have? Do you think we can change it? Is there
do we
just need more budgets?
Well, so yeah, I have two hopes here. Longer term, I absolutely hope that we come around to a revaluing of education. I mean, if you ask people, you were just telling me about your own children. If you ask people what is important to them, what do they value for their children and for their children's futures, almost everyone will put a good education close to the top of the list. And weirdly, I don't think people think as much, at least in the United States, about paying for college tuition as they do the idea of funding education at every level. You know, we pay outlandish amounts to put students through college in the U.S., but people don't want to invest in, say, school infrastructure or the salaries of educators and the like. And I'm hoping that maybe the sense of crisis around the educational system right now, as we are confronting this exponential era of change and realizing that the old system is inadequate, that maybe that can prompt a reconsideration of how do we actually value this thing? And what is a good education worth? And why is that not something that we would want to pay into to make it more universally accessible? That's long term. In the nearer term, I do think that there are opportunities to, as you said, be clever and to deploy new technologies in the field to actually make that experiential and social learning more effective at scale. So I started working fresh out of graduate school for an e-learning startup in Sunnyvale in California. And this was, I think, 2008. And at the time, the idea of a digital learning experience, it was basically just a web page with some hyperlinks. This will take you to another page. This will take you to a video. It was a very, 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 very poor approximation of the classroom experience. Mm-hmm. And for a while, people were really enthused about, the future of digital learning, that we might have these massively open online courses, that first wave of MOOCs, that was going to be the game-changing moment. But it still tended to be a very poor approximation of the traditional classroom. It was worse because it was digital. The only virtue really was that it was accessible to everyone. But now I think we may be starting to turn a corner where we can realize designs that are actually better because they're digital. I know you spoke with Aaron Frank earlier, and Aaron talked a little bit about the possibility of creating experiences in virtual reality or creating applications for augmented reality that allow learners to do and see and to experience things that would otherwise be totally unavailable. And when we can start to design around the capacities of that tool and really start to think not in terms of, well, what was the old system like and how can we digitize it, and instead think of, in a digital first environment, what is the strongest experience? How can we bring people together to facilitate immersive social learning? I think there are opportunities there, and I think it's important to remember that right now, the technologies are the worst they're ever going to be. You know, this is as bad as it gets. It's only going to get better from here. And that means that it's going to be more powerful, easier to use, and cheaper to implement at scale. So I hold out some hope there.
Yeah, same with me. So let's switch to adult education. So I'm 53 years old. I still have the feeling I have to go back to college. I'm just screening the market about how could I get into artificial intelligence. So there's Udacity, there's MIT who's offering online courses. Do you think that the adult education, that this is better because there's more money in the place, or do you think we have to reinvent this as well?
Well, so first I would question whether adult learners like yourself, where it's a continuing education, necessarily need and or are looking for the same thing that primary or secondary age students are looking for. And I think for somebody like yourself, and this is obviously going to be a real growth opportunity at scale, there are going to be more and more people embarking on a second or a third career by choice or by necessity. And so there's a lot to be done in allowing people to upskill and to unlearn and then relearn new things. And I think there, the road ahead might be a little bit more clear. I think there are more people in that circumstance who see the value of almost what we would call learning for its own sake, right? Mm-hmm. That I clearly need to master these skills because there is an opportunity at hand. Whereas if you're 8 or 10, it may not be so clear why you need to be there and what the value of the thing is, and we really have to work at making it engaging and making it serve ends that may not be clear to the user at the time. I think right now we can already see, I mean, you mentioned some of the popular platforms. We can already see the opportunities for really personalized, individualized, branched learning at, you know, the micro or nano credentialing scale. And I think there, part of what can make it more effective is actually being able to map outcomes onto different learning tracks. So let's say you decide in your 40s or in your 50s that you want to embark on a new endeavor, and you look around and it's kind of a crowded landscape. There are a lot of offerings out there, and knowing what is actually the right pathway that's going to get me to where I want to be, I think there's still a lot of opportunity to better evaluate that, to make the system smarter and more responsive so that it is more adaptable to the individual learner. But to me, that seems like something that is pretty near at hand.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk a little bit about Singularity University and about your job there. So as I read, exponential thinking is one of your topics. It's one of the topics of Singularity. Why do you believe in exponential thinking, and why do you believe it's the time to start to think like this? And how does it work?
Yeah, so that was a lot of questions there. So I guess we can start with why. And I would argue that why exponential thinking is particularly necessary at this moment in time is that our established modes of thinking about the future and reasoning future performance from past experience, that tomorrow I'm going to wake up to a day where the sun will shine down and it will be more or less like the day before. And not just my yesterday, but my parents yesterday, my grandparents yesterday. That's less and less reliable. You know, consider, again, we were talking about education a moment ago. Consider if you wanted to be a doctor 10 years ago or 20 years ago or 30 years ago, you probably were looking at pretty much the same path, and you probably had a pretty good sense of where you thought the field might be by the time you finished your degree and your residency and your rotations and whatnot. I'm not sure that's the case anymore. Now I think the context is changing so rapidly that to be able to make sense of that, we need to change the way that we're thinking about the future and thinking about the pace of change. If it is exponential, then we need to learn to think exponentially as well.
So how does your university deliver this? So what is your offering to people like me? So how do you bring this to ground?
Yeah, well, I think actually where we are provides a pretty good example, right? So one of the most important things, and I touched on this in the session this morning, is convening community, right? I think, again, this is going to be a more efficacious experience if it can be a social one, right? Like the learning is still valuable, but the harder the task that you're trying to master, and I think designing for a better future is a pretty complex task, the more important it is to have social reinforcement in the learning, to be learning together and to have other people to draw upon. So we convene a group, and we do offer these kinds of things, these experiences online, digitally, but I think there's still something about being exposed to these ideas in a conversation that really matters. Convening a group and then kicking off with kind of a break with the known, where we try to make the case powerfully that tomorrow will not be like today, that we are going to be living in a world of increased volatility, ambiguity, complexity, and uncertainty. And that if we want to steer towards our preferred future, and if we want to be able to build resilience against the futures that we don't want to inhabit, that we have to get better at designing for that future. And we have to get better at understanding the development of the tools so that we can put them to the best ends to create solutions together so that we can build that world. And so I think we start, as I said, with kind of that hopefully moment of kind of awakening to where we are, where mm-hmm. we might be going if we don't change, and then where we could go if we do the right things. And then from there, exposure at a little bit greater length and a little more depth to some of the core technologies that comprise this exponential tool set, and thinking not only about what they are, but about what they can do in terms of producing better outcomes for society, right? This is part of Singularity's mission, is leveraging emerging technologies for social good, empowering tomorrow's leaders to, in some cases, solve the problems that today's leaders have just sort of set up.
Very cool. You had very nice examples during your speech. Let's maybe talk a little bit about the examples, but I think because I think the examples are very good to underline what you're talking about. So we were talking about, and this was very funny because you related this to your Texas heritage, which was the lab growth hamburger, the first one. Cost $300,000 was
Europe,
this case?
Yeah, so even more.
Maybe we start with this topic because okay. I think it's very interesting.
Sure. Anything in particular about it, or just to relate?
I think the whole issue of why do we do stuff
okay.
like this?
Sure. And got you. Yeah. So the reason I particularly like that example is that I don't want the message to be lost in a rush of holy wow technologies. I don't want people to walk away from a Singularity experience thinking technology is the solution. Technology is going to solve all our problems, because it's not, right? And it's important to me for everyone in the room to see that they have a role in solving these challenges. And so when I talk about that particular example, the way that I like to think of it is this. Mark Post, the gentleman who's on faculty at Singularity U, the Netherlands, he's also at the University of Maastricht. He is widely known as the father of the world's first lab-grown hamburger, right? And so this is cultured meat. It's meat basically grown in a petri dish without the cow, right? That's where they get the genetic info, is from a cow, but from there, they can just grow the thing. And that's important because decoupling the production of animal products from the animal itself means that you don't have to have so many animals to produce these things.
And you don't have to kill them.
Exactly. You also don't have to have such a wickedly, ethically compromised system as industrial meat production, for example. And that's a fabulous thing. Now, a 300,000 euro meat patty doesn't look like a viable solution to world food security. But we know, because that's a technology that has been developing exponentially, that it's getting a lot cheaper. And the last time I checked in with Mark, this was maybe a year or so ago, the price of producing one of those patties was getting closer to the 13 euro mark.
Wow.
Right? Not that they were doing it at that scale, but they could now. The technology had matured to that point. And that's getting a lot closer to a viable solution. But the question still remains, how many people are interested in eating this lab-grown burger, right? How many of us really want to taste the future of food? Now, I've kind of conducted a little bit of a survey across many Singularity programs, and I'll ask people to raise their hands to that question. And lots of people will put their hand up. But there, self-selecting at a singularity program. And I can tell you, people like probably my parents, I said I grew up in Texas earlier. I grew up in a household where we ate meat, you know, twice a day, most days. And I think the idea of selling people on lab-grown meat, or in other cases with similar technology, eerily meat-like substitutes that are produced from vegetable protein, the kinds of things that like Impossible Foods or Beyond Meat are doing right now, those also, I think, have an innate appeal to some people, and then they're going to be a really tough sell to others. And so to me, that suggests that just having the technology available is not enough to guarantee a sticky solution to a really, really big problem. Instead, we have to think about, well, what is the human element? How can we ensure or support the political, cultural, and organizational will to make these things effective at scale and to make them appealing solutions to more people? I believe very much that what we need to be working at is making it easier for people to act in ways that align with their values and to align with the good overall, right? I think we need to be designing human systems that facilitate those kinds of outcomes. And for that, thinking like a technologist is not enough. We also need to have everybody on board as futurists, innovators, humanitarians, in effect, coming together in kind of a common cause. So even if you're not the technologist, you still have a role in this. Like mm-hmm. Mark Post, when I last caught up with him, told me that he was starting to work on thinking about how do they brand this thing? How do they make this more palatable, so to speak, to more people? One thing also was that they were learning to culture fat cells with the meat, because that's going to make the burger a little bit tastier.
But you mentioned the first one was okay.
Yeah, that's what he said. He said it tasted okay.
It was not wow.
Yeah, exactly.
Und bevor es mit dem On the Way to New Work Podcast weitergeht, die kurze Werbepause. Es geht heute um den Werbepartner Mercedes-Benz. Und deswegen spreche ich das ein, denn wie ihr wisst, ich habe gar kein Auto. Michael weist mich ja regelmäßig darauf hin. Ich suche immer noch, und hier wird es jetzt interessant, Mercedes hat den EQC vorgestellt. Das ist ein komplett erstes eigenes elektronisches Fahrzeug. Ne? Electric has now a Mercedes, das ist der Claim. Und darunter steht die Submarke EQ, die noch anders als AMG und Co. wirklich eine neue Ära bei Mercedes einleitet. Und ich kann es mir vorstellen, wir haben ja auch eben die Kollegen von Mercedes im Podcast gehabt und die haben, Sabine hat erzählt eben, was Mercedes davor hat und ich finde es hochinteressant, denn im Kern steht, wie bei New Work auch, der Mensch im Mittelpunkt für neue Services, für innovativere Dienstleistungen, die ich beziehen kann, over the air, wie man so schön sagt, und immer einen Wagen habe, der up to date ist. Das ist das Ziel. Tatsächlich ist es der erste wirklich voll elektronische Wagen. Ich würde es mir mal anschauen auf jeden Fall. Man kann es googeln, aber man kann es auch direkt bei mercedes-benz.de/newwork sich anschauen, was Mercedes hier macht, um das Vertrauen der Marke Mercedes mit der mobilen Zukunft zu verbinden. Der EQ bzw. der EQC unter der Submarke EQ. Und jetzt viel Spaß beim Podcast.
So you were talking about other stuff. The example I find very catching was the Dreamcatcher. Did I get it right? It's
yes.
A software which helps you to design products.
So that is from Autodesk, mm-hmm. and it is an example of a generative design algorithm. So effectively, you have an artificial intelligence that is provided with the parameters. For something that needs to be created as a design. And then it will generate possibilities that satisfy those parameters. And then the user can kind of tweak the parameters a little bit to change the design. But effectively, it can come up with, you know, an infinitude of digital prototypes, many of which, as you saw with that example of the quadcopters,
Amazing.
They don't look like anything a human would design. Another of the examples that Autodesk has put up online, you can see bike frames that the software had come up with. And I'm a cyclist. I own more bikes than I should. My fiance is a very tolerant woman in our tiny apartment in San Francisco. And I've put a lot of bikes together, and I love doing it. And I feel like I'm reasonably knowledgeable about bikes and what makes a good frame. And looking through the things that the Autodesk system has suggested, they don't look like anything I would ever even dream of getting on to ride. And yet, they apparently satisfy all of the parameters to be an effective design. And I don't know what that is exactly, torsional rigidity or the like, but it's interesting to be able to contemplate the idea of leveraging a creativity beyond our own. And we're starting to see examples of designs from these algorithms that actually vastly surpass any human-initiated prototype in terms of efficacy, cost savings, weight, all sorts of things that can be optimized for really effectively within those systems.
What does this mean for people who want to become a designer or an engineer for the future?
That's a really interesting question, and I don't know that I have – well, actually, I certainly don't have the definitive answer. Some of the folks at Autodesk suggest that what this means is that as a designer, you can now have the world's best design mentor sitting next to you, cranking out new possibilities. And I would hope that what this might mean for the designer and for the engineer is that they can spend less time while creating more effective designs. And maybe even this is the opportunity to open things up to thinking about, well, what were we not previously able to optimize for? And that might even ultimately be aesthetics. Maybe we start thinking about if this nails every other parameter that we would be looking for, what is the other thing that I still care deeply about as a designer? And that might be how to make this thing most appealing and engaging to my users, whomever they might be. And I would like to think that maybe this makes some of the brute force computation of prototyping, that goes away now, and might free you up to consider other aspects of the design process and what kind of product you ultimately want to produce.
A friend of mine, Jenny Poleville, she is a Singularity alumni as well. Mm-hmm. She said she uses, instead of artificial intelligence, she uses augmented intelligence. I like this frame. And from what you said, I can feel that you like this phrase as well. So is this a concept? What do you think is right to make it more tangible for people? If I sell them, here is your augmented intelligence, it seems like I'm still relevant.
Yeah, well, and I don't want to argue the position that humans are or even should always have a role in every step of the process and in every job in the field. There are certain things that we just do not do as well as the machine. And I think that we should probably be looking for the things that we can do uniquely well and or find uniquely fulfilling, right? Which are the aspects of the job that I find most resonate with me as an individual? Like which of these are most closely aligned with who I want to be or what I want to do, what impact I want to have in the world? And, you know, there I think, and maybe this is what you were saying, your friend has expressed as well. I think the idea of having artificial intelligence as a partner in the process that is going to make you more effective and perhaps be able to extend your impact, that should be an appealing thing. And there's no shortage in the world of tasks that need doing, and I would argue also things that need to be done better than we do them currently. And I am optimistic and enthusiastic about finding the best way to do those things. And I think so long as they're still serving human users and human ends, using artificially intelligent tools to get there is not something that we should turn away from.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk about the last example you gave us. Was this? I don't know if I got it right. So this was the lady from Stuttgart. Mm-hmm. I was very happy to get a German example as well. She created artificial cells that can grow in the body. I find it amazing. What is it?
So this is a woman named, and I may not get the pronunciation perfectly, so I hope you all will bear with me, Svenja Henderer.
Mm-hmm.
And she works in Stuttgart at the Fraunhofer Institute for Interfacial Engineering and Biotechnology, I believe, is the full title of it. And what she has done is develop a material for a lattice to construct an artificial heart valve. And the material is designed to be biodegradable. So it will decompose over time in the body, but it is coated, I believe, with a protein that attracts cells within the host body that grow onto this lattice such that as the lattice disappears, you're left with now an organic copy of the heart valve. And I mean, one, that's beautiful design. It's an incredible thing. It employs nanotech very effectively. It employs biomimicry very effectively. It's fascinating and elegant as a concept, but it also has real impact in the world where, I think I mentioned this from the stage, you have in Germany every year 30,000 heart valve transplants.
And
in the United States, you have 85,000. So that's just between 200 countries. You have 115,000 of these a year. And for most people, this is not a surgery they have once. If they live a long life, they're going to have it again later. And then they're going to have it maybe even again after that, as the traditional device would eventually degrade, I suppose. And particularly for children, if they have that operation while they're still growing, the life of the traditional device might only be 2 or 3 years because it's not going to grow with the host organ. And now, with what she's working on, there's a possibility of building a thing that is going to be able to grow with the individual over time, which is a lovely design. And there are other benefits to it as well that I believe if it's inorganic when the operation is being done, that's easier to get trials and approval for than putting something into the body that is an organic compound. So it's fascinating.
Amazing.
Work. Yeah, it is. I mean, she's already won quite a few awards for her research and is definitely someone that I was happy to talk about from the stage today.
So we talked about artificial intelligence, about robotics, about this kind of medicine, new medicine. What are other topics you are focusing at Singularity? What are the main disciplines?
Wow. Let's see. So I guess a pretty standard survey of an SU program like this, where we're going to get together for 2 days, we'll be talking about artificial intelligence, robotics, extended reality to comprise AR and VR. Tomorrow, I think you all will be talking about blockchain applications. We talk about digital design and fabrication, 3D, 4D printing, applied neuroscience. Anything right now that is able to leverage abundant computing power right now, that is an exponential technology, right? If it's riding that wave that we've had with Moore's Law and going into whatever happens after that, those are exciting technologies for us. We also often talk, tomorrow you'll hear Carlo van der Weijer talking about mobility, clean tech, renewables, energy and environmental systems. I mean, there's no shortage of subjects, really. I mean, this is part of what's so exciting about where we are right now as a society. There are a lot of threats on the horizon, but we also have more opportunity and more capability than we've perhaps ever had at the species and at the individual level. There's a lot we could do. Now we just have to decide, of all the things we could do, what are the things that we should do? And then which of those are the things that we will do?
Do you focus on the challenges we face? So I remember when my younger son got his graduation from high school, the director of the school had a very nice speech, and he was talking about the, I don't know, was it 15 or 16 challenges the United Nations mentioned?
Yeah, like the Sustainable Development Goals, Millennium Goals.
Are you involved into this?
Yeah, we have a very similar set of challenges that we talk about as the Global Grand Challenges. And we have identified 12. They map really well with the Millennium SDGs. There's a lot of overlap there. And that has been a pretty strong orienting framework, right, to help people think about some of these spaces where if we were able to move the needle, you could touch the lives of very many people around the world. Which is not to say, and I think this is important too, this is not to say that everyone out there needs to be working on a moonshot solution, that if you're not devoting yourself to improving the lives of a billion people, you're not doing it right. I profoundly disagree with that. I think it's really important to engage at the level where you find your passion and your kind of sphere of influence intersecting. And if that's the community level, awesome. That's the place to work up from. If that is at the individual level, awesome. That is a place to work up from. You know, I spend so much time over the last 2 years with Singularity, working with different organizations, talking with corporate clients about how we can transform the organization. And there's a lot to be said there, but I also believe more and more that if you're not transforming the individual, transforming the group has no hope. And so I think it's important for us to be working at multiple levels and then find the place to really dig in and commit and make an impact.
I ask Aaron the same question. So you're working together with so many inspirational people, and you have here in Berlin hundreds of people who tries to get inspiration from you. What are your sources for inspiration besides your colleagues?
Man, the easy answer is off the table then, huh? So I mentioned earlier, just in passing, when we were talking about design of that that heart valve, I mentioned the idea of biomimicry. And I believe that nature is a phenomenal teacher. I mentioned earlier on also that I spent some time as a youth leadership educator, and I was a wilderness educator, and spent a lot of time outside, and studied ecology a little bit, and did environmental education with some of these student groups. And I have found throughout my career that nature and the outdoors and the environment holds, I think, endless possibility for inspiration, and then also endless opportunity for learning about really, 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 really well-designed systems, right? And thinking about that kind of ecological worldview of how everything can be interconnected and how you can facilitate the growth and, not to sound too woo-woo here, but harmony of the whole, by, again, working at the individual level of the components and thinking about the relationships between all of these things such that they wind up being supportive in a holistic sense. And to me, that's endlessly fascinating. So, yeah, get outside.
Get outside. That's yeah. Cool.
And read, of course, also. I mean, that's one of the other beauties of the digital age is the information's abundant. So, you know, we started talking about education and lifelong learning. And you as a podcaster, I can say I appreciate what you do. I listen to a huge number of podcasts. I listen to ebooks. I'm a voracious reader. And, you know, I'm dedicated to my craft. I'm dedicated to our community. And I think, you know, that is what I can do. You know, I'm not a technologist. I came to Singularity as an educator and as a facilitator. And what I can do in this world is connect dots, ideas, and people. So I want to get as good at that as I can.
I think it's a job profile I would love to have. So whenever you step to the next stage, give me a call and I will apply for this job. Really amazing. So as you mentioned reading, so we sometimes ask our guests if they had to name five books which had the most impact on them. Could you name three, four, or five books?
I can definitely name some books for you. I don't know that these are necessarily going to be the ones that have had the most impact on me, but they're. I can definitely name. Yeah, books that I think about a lot.
Yeah, that's good.
Okay. I'm not just saying this because I'm a Singularity University guy, but I would be remiss not to throw out Ray Kurzweil's The Singularity is Near. This is kind of a funny story. I had a brush with that book shortly after its publication where someone had recommended it to me. And I think I was just out of college going into graduate school, and it was a summer, and a copy came across my desk, and I read a little bit of it. And honestly, it read to me as pretty far out there. I read it almost as like sci-fi, techno-philosophizing. And a lot of what Ray was talking about just seemed so far off. And then about 10 years later, I came across it again in a graduate course. And all those things seemed much closer at hand. And I realized just how quickly the paradigms were shifting. So I still think it's a great thing to come back to, and I come back to it often myself. Let's see, what else right now? I just recommended actually to Aaron a book that I'm not through yet, but it's one of the things I'm listening to right now. It's an audio book, but you can buy it in other formats. It's called The Patterning Instinct by Jeremy Lent. And he's a complex systems thinker and is writing a kind of cognitive history of humanity's search for meaning and how we have found meaning in different cultural contexts over time, and how that has influenced the outcomes in the systems that we design and create. And I feel like right now there's been a lot of enthusiasm for Sapiens by Yuval Harari. Mm. And I think this is a nice companion piece to that book, but that it's probably a little bit lesser
more
known.
Positive, probably more positive.
It actually, I think, plays both sides pretty well. And to me, that's probably part of what it means to be honest at this moment in time. I really should have come in better prepared for this question right now. I'm trying to think of what else that could be a really useful answer that aren't books that are mentioned all the time. So my favorite book of mm-hmm. all time is called The Worst Journey in the World. It was written, I believe, in the 1910s by an Antarcticist, an explorer named Apsley Cherry Gerard. And he was the youngest member on the last expedition of Robert Scott.
I heard about it. I have it on my table.
It's an amazing book. I think National Geographic Adventure rated it as the number one adventure book ever written. It's about 600 pages, and he had tried to write it as a manual for future Antarctic explorers, right, to do everything right. But it turned out that he was such a fabulously talented writer and wrote such beautiful prose and such beautiful naturalistic writing that now, 100 years later, we're still reading it, not so much for its informational content, but for its capacity to transport the reader to a place that most of us will never go, and a time that none of us will ever live through. And, you know, it's a fascinating document, I think, of time and place and the way that people were thinking about kind of conquest of the environment, and then also engagement with the natural world and its capacity basically to transform and to help us transcend. And it's an amazing read.
Cool. Jeffrey, thank you so much for your time, your passion, and everything you gave the audience and me personally for this, and our audience for the podcast.
Well, thank you. Happy to be in conversation. I think right now, as ever, but maybe more so than ever, we cannot overstate the value of conversation. It's hard to get people just to sit down and chat. So thank you for having me.